Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where we see the world going, and we talk about the future. And we're not afraid to take a pretty contrarian view of those matters. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic, my friend. How are you doing?
Very good. Glad to be back on Sunday night. I think this is, this is what a lot of our listeners come to expect. So it's probably good that we're here in this time slot.
Well, I was just thinking about the fact that we were on Thursday and then we're on again Sunday. And you remember the old days before Blog Talk Radio, when we used to do this program sporadically, and we had this elaborate technical process we had to go through to produce each show, and it was this horrible hassle doing one, and every time we did one, we would always start out with this apology for the lengthy hiatus since the last show.
Yeah.
every episode started with, sorry it's been so long since we've done a podcast. Well, this time it's like, hey, we're back after just a few days, so
yeah.
Things change rapidly here in this world.
That's awesome. So, we have with us tonight a special guest, again, coming back to finish the show out with us.
Well, we were delighted to have our dear friend, writer and futurist PJ Manning, with us on the show on Thursday as we were setting out the agenda for the future, and PJ has graciously returned to help us conclude that conversation this evening. Welcome back to Fast Forward Radio, PJ.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and I don't know how special a guest I am anymore if I keep coming back.
We hadn't thought about that. Well. You're special to us, okay? You're special to us, and also it's especially great to have you here because our chat host Michael Darling is otherwise occupied this evening with a couple of sick kids, and although I believe he is holding down the fort in the chat room, will not be joining us on the air this evening. So it's great to have that third voice.
Well, Michael, wherever you are, hang in there, buddy.
Hang in there with the kids, yeah.
Yeah.
And get well soon, boys. Absolutely. Well, as I said, we're tackling the agenda for the future. We got about 4 items into a 7-item list last time. And let me just read off the ones that we had worked our way through on Thursday evening. We talked about the end of aging and other diseases, new production technologies, and the end of poverty and hunger, new energy technologies, and technologies to clean up the environment. So tonight, we're going to work through the rest of the list. And Stephen, what's our next item on the agenda?
Well, the next item is artificial intelligence. Are we going to get into that, or are we going to do the 2-to-1 first?
About setting the agenda for the future. I forgot about our 2-to-1 future. Regular listeners will remember our 2-to-1 feature. This is Michael Darling's brainchild. We're going to take, I have actually taken 3 science stories. These are all true science stories, except for one of them, which is false. So 2 of these science stories are true, 1 is false, and the challenge for Stephen and PJ and for Michael in the chat room and anyone else listening in the chat room will be to identify the fake news story. So actually what I think I'll do, Stephen, is I'll read one of these now, and then let's do one of our topics, and then we'll read another one, we'll do another topic, and then we'll come back at the end and see which one's real. How's that sound?
Hey, cool, yeah.
different approach. PJ, how's that work for you?
That sounds good.
All right. So the ayes have it. Okay, so here is our first news story in our 2-to-1 feature this evening. The headline is, could ethanol power future rockets? Could future trips to space be powered by moonshine? In a test firing earlier this month, a California-based engineering firm, Flowmetrics, announced that commercially available ethanol produced almost the same amount of thrust as conventional rocket fuel. The find may not come as much of a surprise. After all, ethanol is already being tested by the airline industry, which gobbles up billions of gallons of jet fuel each year. But despite fluctuating petroleum prices, interest in alternative fuels among rocket builders has been slow to grow. Flowmetrics leader Steve Harrington hopes the test will stoke interest in ethanol-powered rocketry. Most rocket scientists are knee-jerk anti-environmentalists, Harrington says, but we're going to run out of rocket fuel at some point, so what are we going to run our rockets on after that? Okay, so that's story number one, a test showing that you can get just about as much thrust using ethanol as rocket fuel. And we'll come back and we'll get the next two as we go through the program.
Okay.
Got it.
So, Stephen, you were going to tell us
Our first topic tonight is artificial intelligence, and how is this going to fit into the agenda for the future, I guess, and our special guest tonight actually has some has some thoughts on that, I think. Just kind of threw it to you bare like that, didn't I?
You're hanging like that, gentlemen.
Well, sorry about that. That was not the smoothest segue ever.
I was going to say, no NFL games this week, and yet Stephen has pulled off a masterful punt here this evening.
That's right.
Let's see if PJ calls for the fair catch or what happens here.
Well, I guess I'm going to bat it back over the line. My question to you two is, well, I'm assuming you're referring to artificial general intelligence. I think we need to be more specific for our listeners.
Right. Obviously,
intelligence already exists.
Right. That's true. We have artificial intelligence, and we were talking about what do we call the artificial intelligence we have now, Phil? Is it narrow artificial intelligence or weak?
The term I usually use is narrow. Although we were talking about how that term applied AI is maybe a nice way to distinguish from PJ, as you mentioned, artificial general intelligence. So. The distinction being narrow AI or applied AI is artificial intelligence that machine intelligence that can solve a particular problem, that can perform some narrow set of tasks that may or may not, well, that generally would have been thought of as having required intelligence in the past, such as parallel parking a car or winning a chess game or any of a number of things, actually running a typical customer care call on a service call from a call center. A lot of those kind of narrow tasks are now done by artificial intelligence programs versus artificial general intelligence, which is, how would you define that, PJ?
Thinking machines. Machines that can actually problem solve beyond the simple parameters. So in, let's say, in natural language, you can ask Hal a question, and Hal can answer you.
Right.
Exactly. So the classic test for AGI, the kind of old school test, was the so-called Turing test, where through usually like some kind of chat function or some other means, you could have a conversation with a computer, and if you were not able to determine that that was a computer program, if that computer program could fool you into believing that you were just having a conversation with a human being, we would say that has risen to that level. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Not necessarily, because you can pass a Turing test and not really be a thinking machine. In fact, there are a number of her name, Emily. It was the name of a program, and it's actually quite an old program that could simulate a conversation, and with pretty regular consistency fool people into believing they were talking to a human being when in fact they were talking to a machine intelligence, but it wasn't actually an AGI.
I think you're talking about the Alice chatbot. Is that right? Alice?
Was it Alice? Okay, maybe Alice. And then they did another one recently, which actually didn't even perform anywhere near what the old one did from, was it about 10 or 15 years ago? So I don't think for me, it's not just a Turing test. It's a Turing test, I think is quite limited. It would be a combination of the Turing criteria of, you know, do I think I'm talking to a human, but also with a problem-solving ability. Because the irony is we've cracked being able to talk to a human part. It's able to parse out language and respond in kind, usually with questions that turn around your statements or your questions that can fool you into things. But it's not capable of coming up with an original thought.
Right.
Or solving
what
a problem.
What I like about the Turing test criteria is that you have a definition. Now, apparently, it's not sufficient, right? Because it's not actually going to get you to where you can say that's what AGI is. But I think we need a set of criteria that well put together, because I think one of the real problems we're going to face with AGI is this same kind of resetting the goalposts that has been done with intelligence generally, right? There was this whole discussion about whether intelligence is required to play chess. And at one time, everyone would have agreed, well, yes, of course, that's going to be a tremendous test of intelligence. Right up until the moment that a computer beat a grandmaster at playing chess, and then suddenly a lot of people were of the opinion that, no, that's no great test of intelligence to win at chess. And one of the things that's interesting, I think, about that is this tendency to, it's like once something is accomplished, we're not sure if we actually did anything of significance. So, you know, if we don't say what the criteria are going in very specifically, right, in a very straightforward way for AGI, we might have AGI and it will go unacknowledged. Do you think there's any danger of that?
Wow. I doubt it. In fact, if anything, people tend to believe that things that aren't really AGI, like Turing tests, would qualify as AGI. I like to think of it as, you know, you can pass a Turing test and not be capable of learning beyond being able to respond in grammatically correct English to a concept that's been addressed to, you know, the machine, that's been addressed to the machine. The issue with a real AGI, real thinking machine, is that not only can they take in that information, but they assimilate it and they learn from it. So what the machine knows tomorrow could be radically different from what the machine knows today.
Right. Well, and come to think of it, I think the other big difference between, say, an AGI that people now claim is no real proof of artificial general intelligence versus a chess-winning computer that people now say that's no test of intelligence, is the AGI can argue for itself.
Correct.
The AGI will be able to go, hey, no, I really am intelligent. We'll be able to make the case for itself. And
well,
we'll
eventually. It's an eventuality, because, you know, I would even argue that if you could create, like, for instance, you know, someone like Ben Goertzel working on creating a childlike AGI that could eventually learn like a child learns to become an adult AGI or adult level AGI, I would argue that child AGI is an enormous step past beyond anything that we've had before that, because it's capable of actually learning abstract concepts as opposed to simply, you know, I can move pieces on a chessboard because I have so much power and I have so much memory. I can run so many eventualities simultaneously that I will eventually find the right answer through sheer grunt computer power.
Right.
But playing with blocks is a whole different level of...
Yes, it is. Ironically, it is.
Yeah,
a
whole different level,
think,
isn't it? Yeah, I think so.
And learning how gravity works and learning how, you know, at what point can you stop being able to pile those blocks? And if you pile them one way or the other, what's going to happen? And, yeah, and you know, and then being able to apply that knowledge the next time you pile your blocks.
Right.
Wow, yeah, that's a big change. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're setting the agenda for the future. And if you'd care to join our online discussion, that chat room is available if you're listening to us live. If not, please leave a comment at the blog, blog.speculus.com. But let's think about this, and this is where it really starts to get wacky. Once you're to the level of that child, once that child grows and matures to the point that it is able to interact with its environment and understand to some extent what it is and the role it has to play, I would think giving itself that ability to win chess or virtually to master any other human achievement would be a very basic and straightforward thing for that child. That child quickly becomes the most powerful and intelligent entity in the world.
Well, that is the science fiction stories, aren't you know, isn't it? That's and the entire nature of the singularity, if you want to get down to it.
Exactly. So I guess that's the question. Where does artificial general intelligence put us in the short term, middle term, long term? What is the significance of it for the future of humanity?
Well, in the short term, there's the belief that an AGI could solve problems that we're not capable of solving because we can't see enough of the information at once. We can't hold a big enough picture or a big enough context, or it has too many variables. I often look at, you know, the problems that we get ourselves into in the world, and it always seems to come down to the same thing, which is, whoever was making those decisions couldn't see it in that slightly larger context, or in many cases much larger context, that would make the problems would redefine the problems entirely, and make you realize that now I see why that solution wouldn't work. There's a potential that it would allow us to problem solve through computing power in ways we can't do today.
We could say that, put it this way, you know, our problem is we can't see the forest because we can't hold in our minds more than maybe two or three trees at a time.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah.
And that comes, you know, everything we do now is on such a global scale of so many variables affecting so many variables and unintended consequences and everything else, that there is the hope, certainly among AGI enthusiasts, that an AGI would be able to hold all this information and process it in a way that we're not capable of. That's if we create something that has our best interests in mind. And
friendly
that's the
AGI.
Big,
yeah.
Yeah, that's the big, exactly. And there's a lot of debates whether friendly AGI is even, you know, is that even an oxymoron? Is it something that you can't, you know, the very notion of making an AGI friendly may or may not be possible. But certainly, you know, from a near term, if it could problem solve, gosh, wouldn't that be lovely?
Yeah.
Well, I'm intrigued by this idea of the AGI with having this much more complete picture than we have, and just assuming it's assuming for a moment it's friendly, that it's that it's an extension of us, right? That's what we hope to accomplish with artificial general intelligence, is that that's kind of the next step in the evolution of intelligence on this planet, that, that we've achieved a certain level, and now we enable the next level of that. If we can make that happen, if you get this this artificial general intelligence that really does integrate more than we've been able to see a more complete picture than we've been able to, then you've got an event in the history of, like the intellectual history of humanity, that it seems like we've already used the names, and we shouldn't have used them yet, right? I mean, this would truly be the Renaissance, right? This would really be the Enlightenment, right? I mean, we had almost kind of precursor events back, a few centuries ago that we put those names on, but the singularity becomes the real Enlightenment for humanity. It becomes the real Renaissance of humanity itself, assuming that you have an entity that's working in our interest, that shares our interest with us, that sees itself as one of us.
There is one other issue, though. It's beyond just the friendly aspect, and this comes back to a machine is only good as the information it's capable of being programmed. And, you know, in our machines now, in our artificial intelligences now, which are narrow, we still suffer from being unable to put in enough information to model correctly. You know, the banking crisis is actually a perfect example of what happens when you don't put in all the information into a model. Gosh, they only went as far back as the last boom started. So there was never any information on what happens when there's a bust. So there's a perfect example of, well, if we didn't tell the machine everything it needs to know, and that's up to us to figure out as well, what information can we give this machine to help us make a decision?
You know, that's a beautiful segue into our next topic. Actually, one way of doing that would be through one way of doing that would be through virtual worlds. I would think that being able to raise the childlike artificial intelligence as a real child, I doubt that we'll have robotics advanced enough to give this AI a artificial body, but you could certainly put him in an artificial world and raise that child like you would a regular child within that virtual world.
Well, again, that's something that Ben Gertzel has been exploring with other people to develop, that belief that you can give them the world as the playground to learn on. But again, it's making sure that world has everything it needs and everything it needs to learn. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and it's hard to know what that stuff is, but at some point the child takes over, right? At some point the child starts telling us what it needs to know, rather than us having it a complete picture of what it needs to know. Maybe it starts asking us these very bizarre, out of left field sounding questions because it's starting to get a more complete picture. In fact, that'll be one of the clues that we're starting to make some progress. When the child shows a precociousness and a curiosity about things that seem so completely unrelated. When we're trying to teach that child about the economy, and the child is asking us all about, I don't know, the environment and music and nutrition
and funny childlike questions like, do dogs have dreams, or, you know, things like
yeah.
And the answer to that is yes, by the way. But
yeah, I remember my dog running in her sleep.
Yeah. So
there it is.
Anyway, yeah, kids ask the darndest things, and I guess I agree completely. When you have an AGI that starts, or you have an AI that starts acting like that, maybe at that point it's an AGI. I agree.
Or it's moving in that direction anyway, because when you start making those kinds of connections, and I think that's probably what would have been missing, PJ, even if we'd had financial models that went all the way back to the beginning of the markets, right? What was missing was whether dogs have dreams and how that might be impacting their
I don't disagree with you, actually. I really agree. I think that that's and that will be the challenge of the virtual world creators, to create a virtual world where dogs have dreams.
Right, because the world will have to be rich enough. This is actually one of the great disappointments of movie going in the last decade or so, was when the movie AI came out and I first saw the preview for it. I was certain that this artificial intelligence would actually be living in a computer, that it would be a virtual world, not that it would be like a cute kid robot running around, you know, having adventures, but that it would be this, just from the original trailer, I got the impression it would be actually be a computer program running that had no idea that it wasn't a real human being, which somebody still ought to make that movie, because that would be a really cool story to tell. But the point is, whatever that world is, that has to have all the richness of our world. It has to enable all the complexity and paradox and just weirdness of this world in order to enable that same level of thinking and to get that entity beyond us. And what's great about that is, if we have an artificial world with that level of richness, it not only benefits the AI, but it's great for us too, just in terms of entertainment and in terms of interacting with each other, in terms of education. There's an awful lot we can do with an environment like that, and it becomes very very beneficial for just plain humanity, as opposed to this next stage of humanity.
Yes.
No one's arguing with that one. And I think, you know, we're moving in that direction right now with primarily with games, although there's also environments like, I mean, the one that comes to mind is Second Life, which is sort of a game and not exactly a game, but it's kind of set up to be this precursor virtual world. But it fails in a lot of ways to match the complexity and the richness of our world, although it gives you benefits that you don't have. The one I always like to mention is that you can fly in Second Life, and I think that's very cool. But
I like what Harvey's saying.
What's that?
I'm sorry, Phil. I like what Harvey's saying in the chat room. He'd be impressed with a virtual world that has smells. A world with smell would be, you'd begin to be getting to the world with a sort of bandwidth that it might take for an AGI. So.
Well, I was going to actually say one of the reasons I've never joined Second Life, even though I write about things like Second Life, is that, you know, it doesn't really interest me. There's not enough there.
Yeah.
There's not enough experience for me there. And for someone who enjoys utilizing as many senses as I can, I don't really get it in a kind of fun. I understand it intellectually, but from an emotional standpoint, it doesn't speak to me at all.
Well, that's the thing. You can fly, but you don't feel it.
Right.
You know, I mean,
you know, I'd like to feel it.
That's a big drawback. Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to fly, I'm going to be one of those guys in those bat suits. You know, that there you. Now we're talking. Like a real guy in a bat suit. But you know, the ones that look like flying squirrels.
Exactly.
You know the guys I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like sure, I'd want to be that guy. I'd want to be that guy in real, not in Second Life.
Well, what I want is there to be a Second Life where I can feel that and experience that and not be risking crashing into a rock and dying. See, to me, that's the that would be the advantage of a virtual environment, would be being able to eliminate risk from those kinds of activities, or just being able to, you know, I could sit in my home and be surfing the big waves up there on the north shore of Oahu, right? It's like you can have all these different experiences without actually having to go to those different places, that this virtual world becomes accessible through the computer. But yeah, I agree. I mean, going back to the idea of, you know, it's got to smell like something. And when Ben Gertzel was on this program, he talked about the fact that it's got to feel like something. He talked about how the textures in Second Life are really just visuals. There's no tactile sense to it at all, and that even in the earliest implementations, you could just walk right through walls. You could just stick your hand through a wall. I mean, the walls didn't even stop you, right? So now they've at least gotten to the point where walls will stop you, and, you know, there's some kind of rudimentary gravity and some of those kinds of things. But no, Harvey, you can't smell yet, and, you know, nothing tastes like anything, nothing feels like anything. So Second Life, I think, yeah, has got a long way to go before it provides that level of richness. But that's something to look forward to, not only because of the environment it provides for the AIs, but also because of what it gives to all of us.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're just about to do our second news story in 2-to-1. And the second story is Scientists Solve a Mystery. Three fish are all the same. That's our headline. So, researchers believe they have solved the puzzle of three seemingly different fish, one all males, one all females, and one all juveniles. They're the same fish, and they undergo remarkable changes as they mature. You can imagine it was a pretty exciting discovery, said G. David Johnson, an ichthyologist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. The pieces kept falling into place. And it tells you how little we know about the deep sea, Johnson said in a telephone interview. So, Stephen, this goes back to our Astounding Science Facts a couple weeks ago. We were doing Mysteries of the Deep. Here's another mystery of the deep. This one's been solved.
Yeah.
The fish live in the sparsely populated deep water thousands of feet below the surface, though as youngsters they rise to shallower levels where there's more to eat. Sedimimidae, a type of whale fish, had been known since the 19th century, but only females had been found. Seemingly related species called Meropenidae or tape tails and Mycetoridae or big nose fish were identified in the 1950s and 1960s. Tape tails were only found as juveniles and big noses only as males. So what were long believed to be three distinct species of fish will now all be classified as Sedimimidae, he said. Okay, so story number one was ethanol-powered rockets. Story number two, three different species of fish have now been consolidated into one species of fish.
All right, okay.
I can hear the gears grinding.
Yeah.
Was it that obvious?
I'm liking that story, but I'll give my guess here after the third one.
Yeah, we'll have to wait till we get to the third one, but let's move on to our final topic on the future agenda, which is the real space program, the real age of space. And the reason I use that terminology was I just wanted to, I guess kind of like I was having fun with my idea of the real Renaissance there too, that everything that's come before, everything that's kind of up to this point, because we went through this period in the late 60s and early 70s, they called it the 60s through the early 70s, they called that the space age. But I don't think we're really in the space age yet. And I think when we're in the real space age, that's going to be a period of humanity actually occupying space, not just using it for communication and not just exploring it, but actually settling into space and either settling on other planets or possibly building settlements out in the asteroids or elsewhere, even eventually moving on to star travel. So how do we get to that real age of space? Why aren't we there yet, I guess, it would be the first question.
Well, the expense. We don't have ethanol-powered rockets yet. Maybe that's the problem. But, launching rockets, I mean, is just a very inefficient way of getting into outer space. What we really need is the space elevator. And we've got some technical challenges before we ever even get close to that. So and imagine how great it would be, you know, basically taking a ride, just a few miles, 60 or so, and being in outer space. And once you accomplish that, getting out of breaking the gravity well of the Earth, the rest of the solar system kind of opens up to you at that point.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, I think, go ahead, TJ, sorry.
I was going to say, it's expensive, and there also has to be the social and political will, which is tied to the expense. But there has to be a real desire to go to space, because it's a hard problems to solve that will take an awful lot of focused energy and money and technology to solve.
Yeah.
It's a huge set of challenges that would have to be overcome to get us to the place where what I described would be happening, where people are actually making their home there, where commerce is occurring there. I think it's interesting that Stephen Hawking has become a major advocate of humanity moving into space over the past couple of years. And I don't know if either of you have read any of the I think we've linked it a couple times, Stephen, that things he said, just from a standpoint of the survival of humanity depends upon us eventually not just living on this one planet. It's a way of, and I think our friends from Lifeboat Foundation would agree with this, that one of the ways you ensure the ongoing human race is to not have all our eggs in one planetary basket, as it were, to have us living as spread out as we can, not just in this solar system, but maybe in multiple star systems out across the galaxy, so that eventually some big cosmic event doesn't take us out if nuclear war or one of these other potential existential risks doesn't get us. So I think that given the technology and given the economic feasibility of doing it, the reason to do it is there. Although I'm not sure that people would move out into space to save humanity. I mean, that might be part of their thinking, but I think they would do it because it would be an adventure. I think they would do it because they would think it's like an opportunity to be part of the frontier, to be part of the next stage in where humanity is going.
But generally, when there's a frontier, there has to be a real motivation to enter the frontier. And usually, it's either the thought of financial security, or because you've been persecuted where you are, and any place is better than here.
Yeah. So that's primarily what brought people to the United States at first. I mean, it wasn't an easy thing to do to get to the United States and then to make a life here. Wasn't even the United States then. To get to the New World wasn't an easy thing to do, and then to carve out a life out of the wilderness. Obviously, they had to have big motivations, and one of them was religious and political freedom, I guess.
And actually, there's actually a third reason why people end up in the wilderness, and that's because they've been sent there as a punishment. I forgot about Australia. But, you know, there is the whole concept of a penal pioneers.
Yeah. Australia was populated by people that were sent there for punishment. So you can imagine an outer space colony as a penal farm, huh?
You're right. I'm not suggesting it. I'm just saying that, you know, there are three reasons people go to the frontier: to make money, to stop being persecuted, or because they were sent there to be punished.
Yeah.
Well, we've got one absolute skeptic in the chat room, I see, Pastor Pat, who says that people moving into space is a pipe dream, and it's just Hollywood movie stuff. I assume Pastor Pat was not on earlier when we were talking about artificial general intelligence, or he would have really enjoyed that discussion. But I would point out that one of the remarkable things that we've gotten to see in our lifetimes, and that we'll see a lot more of, is that things that seem well outside the realm of possibility move quickly into the realm of possibility. Actually sending someone to the moon was, in the memory of some people still living, a pipe dream and just Hollywood movie stuff until it happened. A lot of the technology we see around us was outrageous futuristic stuff even just a few years ago, and we see tremendous advances in medical technology and in other areas that all of which give me reason to think that that the move into space will occur not just because we need some place to send criminals. I certainly hope that that's not the only thing that that comes into play. I think that swinging it back around to your earlier point, Stephen, that the space elevator has a huge role to play in in making that happen. And why don't you say a little bit about what that is and why you think that's an important aspect to whether we actually at some point move into space.
When the first time I ever heard the concept space elevator, it was back in the late 70s. I was just a kid then, and the idea was fascinating. There was this idea that, you know, we could build this tower and basically take an elevator up this tower into space, and the tower would look like a giant radio tower or something like that. It'd be a metal, rigid tower, and they had in mind this material that it would be made out of, and they called it fictionite in this article I read. And it had to have a tensile strength, you know, hundreds of times the tensile strength of tungsten fibers, and, you know, just it was an idea that, you know, basically the article is basically saying, you know, this is probably why it'll never happen. This material is just it's just too strong. It's outside the realm of what is possible. Well, the space those who consider themselves space elevator enthusiasts now have a different idea of what a space elevator would look like. It would be a ribbon of carbon nanotubes stretching from an equatorial site into outer space, and it would be very, very, it would be, you know, maybe 3 or 4 feet wide, but, you know, atomically thin, basically, because it would be maybe a single layer of carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes do have the strength necessary, theoretically, to create this kind of space elevator, and so you know, obviously you have to overcome a lot of things. You have to produce carbon nanotubes in quantities we've never been able to do before. Matt in the chat room was talking about you know, we can do it now for maybe one centimeter. I think it's actually more than that. I think
it's actually much more than that. I just read oh golly, like a meter at least.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we're up to about a meter now, and
yeah.
you can imagine, you know. And we were formerly we were talking about microscopic amounts. So we're jumping by orders of magnitude in what we can produce, but it's still a long, long way off at this point. And then there'll be other technical hurdles. How do you power the climbers that climb up this this thing? But you know, so let's say we accomplish all these things. I mean, you can imagine the first country, if it's done by nation states, the first country to produce this will have such a leap on everybody else in outer space that it'll be, you know, extremely inexpensive to go into outer space at that point. It'll be, you know, it'll be something we can do kind of almost without thinking, like an airline.
Well, that's really the transcontinental railroad into space. At that point,
right.
is what you have. You've got this just tremendous leap forward in the ability to move material into space and move material from space if that were to become an issue. And what you've done is you've beaten the gravity well of Earth, which is a huge problem for space travel. Getting around in space doesn't actually require all that much energy. It's getting off Earth that takes all the energy. So you take that problem out of the equation, and suddenly the problem of sending material into space to put structures up there, to put satellites up there, to move where it would make sense, manufacturing into a zero-gravity environment, suddenly that capability isn't as big a deal as it was. When we talk about things like potentially the helium-3 that's on the moon might become a tremendous energy source for us on Earth, well, how would we ever get to it? Well, you know, having an easy, inefficient, inexpensive way to get into low Earth orbit gets you a lot closer to the moon than we are without that. And suddenly things that weren't economically feasible, you know, become a little bit closer to being economically feasible. But I still think that that's a problem, and it kind of spins us into the next part of the discussion, which is how each of these different models of the future work together. How do each of the items on the agenda, how do they depend on each other? What are the priorities for them? So we'll talk about that in just a moment. First, let me say this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're setting the agenda for the future. We're having a lot of fun in the live chat. If you're listening live, please join us in the chat or leave your comments at blog.speculus.com. Now, before we go setting the agenda for the future, let me just read our third and final 2-to-1 story. Okay, this is the shortest of them all. And here's the headline: Delhi to outlaw plastic bags. Customers and shopkeepers in India's capital face jail sentence or stiff fine for using polythene bags. Carry a plastic bag in Delhi and you could be in prison for 5 years. Officials in India's capital have decided that the only way to stem the rising tide of polythene is to outlaw the plastic shopping bag. According to the official note, the use, storage, and sale of plastic bags of any kind or thickness will be banned. The new guideline means that customers, shopkeepers, hoteliers, and hospital staff face a 10,000 rupee fine, which is then translated for us as 1,370 pounds. I still don't have that in dollars, but figure you can double that anyway, right, to get that to dollars, probably somewhere in the vicinity of $3,000, I'm guessing, and a possible jail sentence for using non-biodegradable bags. Okay, so to review, our three stories were ethanol-powered rockets, three different species of fish, which all turned out to be one species of fish, and the city of Delhi in India outlawing plastic bags. So we'll come back and get everyone's votes on two of those are true, one of those is false, and find out which one of those is false at the end of the program. Okay, so where has this journey taken us? We've gone through the end of aging and other diseases, new production technologies and the end of poverty and hunger, new energy technologies, technologies to clean up the environment, artificial intelligence, artificial virtual worlds, and the real space age. So I'll give it to you first, Stephen, and then to you, PJ. What's the order that these things happen in, or what's the highest priority, or what dependencies do you see amongst all of these?
You know, our challenge in the future is that they're not going to come in an orderly fashion. We might get four or five of these things that happen all at one time. And, you know, perhaps it'd be helpful to have the artificial intelligence to help us sort it out. Right, PJ? I mean,
that seems to be what most people would like to see happen first, but that doesn't mean it's going to.
That's right. I've often said, I believe I'm on record, Phil, is saying that we're going to have some form of life extension technology within just a few years. I believe the time frame I made for myself, I think we're down to now 7 years. Do I think that that's going to be, we'll reach actuarial escape velocity? No, I don't. I think that what we're talking about is some treatment for a disease of aging that in actuality extends life for everybody. And I would expect to see something like that within the next 7 years or so. Production technologies, atomically precise production technologies, is something that you would need, for example, for space elevators. I mean, I think you just about need to have nanobots in order to even maintain something like that. And of course, and if you've got if you have that, then that solves a lot of other problems too, doesn't it? And of course,
absolutely.
And then energy technology comes along for the ride along with that, and then artificial intelligence and artificial virtual worlds will develop alongside all of the rest of it. So, how it will interact—that's the big question, isn't it? I couldn't say.
Okay, here's easy question. If you could only pick one to see in your lifetime, which one?
that's easy. Life extension technology, because I get to see the rest of it if my life is extended. So that's the one I would want to have happen. So
actually, as I deconstruct my question, that's wrong, because your life would go on. None of the rest of those things would happen. By choosing that one, you would prevent humanity from moving forward in any of those other areas, Stephen.
How that's selfish of me. Oh gosh!
Better go with AGI. All right. Okay. PJ, same same question over to you. What do you think? Is there an order to these? Is there a set of dependencies?
No.
There's
dependencies, but they're also hidden. Hidden relationships between these. Some are really obvious, as Stephen was pointing out. You know, if you have production technologies, that's you're going to change your energy and your cleanup technologies. Also, working at the nano level allows you to create longevity technologies. I mean, it's all very interrelated. Usually, when I either listen or talk to futurists, they split into two camps. Most usually believe AGI should come first. That's the chicken or the egg. I guess it's the egg. Some believe nanotechnology, simply because it allows for so many problem-solving technologies. So that's, I would have to say AGI, because I think that if we could create a thinking machine that can actually think about the unintended consequences better than us, that would be a great thing, because now we're looking down the barrel at some very powerful technologies. And I'd like to see them all be used for good and have a minimal downside. Because even good technologies have downside. I mean, you know, technology is morally neutral. You can use it for good or evil. So if we could come up with AGI that could help us solve those problems, that's probably where I'd go.
I'm with you, but I find that scary. A machine that knows better than me about my life or my world, you know. But
actually,
there's a scary side to that too. There's a scary side to leaving it in the hands of humans. So I mean, you know, I'm with you.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
I think that to attempt to answer it myself, I believe that there are definitely dependencies. I think that probably, going back to the question of whether, I think it's a really interesting question of whether we'll ever move into space, whether that's just a pipe dream. It is a pipe dream if you don't have a radical economic transformation. I think if we have the production technologies that allow for a space elevator and we have the kind of economy that we've talked about, Stephen, in the last couple of programs, the kind of robot-powered super economy that certainly could be coming. At that point, it becomes feasible. It becomes feasible for us to start thinking about making that kind of a move. The only other thing I think that would get us up there would be, it really would be a movie pipe dream. It would be the When Worlds Collide scenario. Right. If another planet was about to smash into ours, and we had enough of a heads up, that might actually get us off Earth. That might be the one thing that would inspire us to do it. But I'm always stuck between those two. Is it that we need the molecular precise nanotechnology to empower the world so that we can create AGI, or do we need AGI to help us figure out how to produce this world? And I'm never 100% sure. It seems to me that that there's an Escher-esque hands drawing themselves thing going on there, and somehow we have to bootstrap ourselves to both of those by the progress that we make with each. But I do have an easy answer to the if I could only live to see one. It would definitely be the real space age, because Stephen, then I'd be able to take my retirement cruise.
Yeah.
You've summed up the whole convergence technology concept right there, which is you have, you know, be it information technology, nanotechnology, robotics, and genetic technology, you have a group of technologies that, you know, they're tools. They're not actually ends in of themselves. And they together in different combinations create technologies.
One thing is for sure, that we have to be smarter, I think. I think we've gotten smarter. I actually think we have. But we have to get a lot smarter in order to be able to do a lot more things. So So the convergence definitely has to either include artificial general intelligence, or it just has to somehow empower humanity becoming more intelligent than we are. Would you both agree with that?
Well, keep in mind my argument that we already are smarter, in part because we all have a brain prosthetic in the form of Google and everything else. If we're lacking in some area of knowledge we think we need, research is pretty easy now. It's our fingertips at all times.
Okay. Well, I think that's got it then. We've laid out the agenda for the future, and it sounds like we're not quite sure. Is that where we ended up?
Which I think is just about right.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. If we're going to be honest.
Well, I would have to say that does open us up to do more programs in the future. I'd hate for this to be the last Fast Forward Radio. So we'll keep trying to set the agenda. We've made a yeoman start here, but I think we've got a long way to go. Okay, so we're going to swing it back around now, and everyone is going to get to vote on which story was the false story. To review, we had a new story about ethanol being used to power rockets, a new story about three species of fish that turned out to be one species of fish, and we had a new story about the city of Delhi in India has banned plastic bags. Now, I've been following in the chat room, and I believe it was Harvey early on who expressed some skepticism about story number one, and that has been mirrored by Pastor Pat. I've also seen some big-time skepticism about the fish story. So anyone else in the chat room, if you have thoughts on what's true and what's false, go ahead and chime in. And, Stephen, I'll give it to you. What's your analysis?
I'm going to join the guys in the chat room and say I believe that the false story is the ethanol rocket fuel. It makes no logical sense with the reason I chose this, but I think the second story is just too good to be fake. I love that story. The three fishes are all the same, so I want that one to be true. And the last story, it just rang true to me as well. Although I don't know what that would necessarily accomplish, outlawing the plastic bags. Instead of having these environmentally unsound plastic bags, we cut down all our trees to make paper bags. So,
right.
That one sounds perhaps ill-considered environmental policy, and we tend to do things like that. So I'm going to go with two and three being correct, and number one being incorrect, the ethanol-powered rockets. So.
Okay, so your vote is that the ethanol rocket is false. Okay. While we've been talking about this, I've seen two votes come in for number two being false. Two of our listeners in the chat room think that number two sounds like a typical fish story, and we got three votes now for the ethanol rocket being false in addition to Stephen. So Patricia, it's up to you. What's the winning answer?
Okay, the Delhi story sounds absurd enough to be true. Only because I do know the Indian government, it can be famous at times for overreacting to issues like this. The fish story sounds totally plausible to me, so I have no problem believing that one. Ethanol, isn't rocket fuel made of ethanol? I'm just taking a guess here. I thought it actually was ethanol.
Which would be a good reason why it would be a fake story.
Right. I don't know. So, I mean, so that's why
so
my
if
choice
it was
is one.
Normally made of ethanol, then a story talking about it being a big breakthrough would be false. Is that your point?
Yeah, I think. The irony is you know, when it comes to space stuff, I usually keep my mouth shut because. It's not my area of expertise, but I could have sworn that it jet fuel. Okay, I'm done.
Okay.
Well, let me just tell you, I don't know if they include ethanol in rocket fuel or jet fuel normally, but your instincts have served you absolutely correctly. That and Stephen and a number of you in the chat room, story number one is the false story. So yes, the city of Delhi is going to start arresting people for using plastic bags. I'll provide the link in the show notes, and you should see the mess they have there. It is terrible. They're in desperate straits trying to get rid of plastic bags in Delhi. It's a bad situation. Amazing story about these three fish. What were thought to be three distinct species of fish, because they look so different, whether they're male or female, or whether they're juvenile or fully grown, turns out they're all the same fish. So that's just a very cool story. And story number one, here's what I did. Okay, I just took it into Notepad and I did a find replace. I replaced with ethanol the word what?
Biodiesel
is absolutely right, Stephen. The actual story was about biodiesel being used to power rockets, and that test did take place, and I'll provide a link to that actual story. So congratulations to all of you who got it right. For those of you I faked out with the fish story, better luck next time. We'll have another 2-to-1 on an upcoming program. Well, I see we're getting close on our time, Stephen, so let me turn it over to you and what's going on music-wise.
The song tonight is Radio by William Saunders, with special guest on this song, Heather Thornton. So that's our music tonight. The name of the song, again, is Radio.
Radio, William Saunders and Heather Thornton singing Radio. Very appropriate. There's a lot of discussion going on in the chat room about radio tonight. So interesting that you would choose that song. Well done. Thank you for your contribution. PJ, always a pleasure and a delight having you on the program. Please come back and join us. Even if you're here every week, you'll always be special to us.
Thank you, gentlemen. My pleasure.
Thank you to all our friends in the chat room. Michael Darling, get well soon to the boys. And to everyone listening, we will be with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Take a ride, no.